Chapter 36. Michael leaned through into the hallway while doing up his tie. Kelsey was tugging on her shoes in a hurry.
"Don't work too late tonight, my love," he said softly.
"Are you my boss now?"
snapped Kelsey.
"I'm worried about you. That's all."
"I'm fine."
"You know what I mean."
"I said I'm fine. Stop overthinking things. Get the boys to school and get yourself to work, okay?"
Michael's face fell, wounded. Kelsey rolled her eyes and paced over to him. She gave him a quick peck on the cheek, squeezed his hand, then marched to the car where Olive was waiting. Michael followed her to the doorstep, the cold stone sapped warmth from his feet.
"Have you heard from my mom lately? She's not returning my calls," called Michael.
Kelsey pretended not to hear as she climbed into the car.
"Have a great first day, sweetie. You'll be great," called Michael.
His daughter gave him a sarcastic thumbs up, then pointed to her usher's uniform and pretended to vomit. She was clearly enthralled by her new holiday job. Michael waved them off, then nipped back into the hallway. He slipped on his shoes and grabbed a blazer, then called to his sons who were feasting at the breakfast table.
"Damien, Leon, don't be late for school, and make sure there's some bread left for the rest of us, you pair of locusts."
He grabbed his satchel and set off toward the tram stop. As he neared the interchange, he slipped off the sidewalk and took up position on a nearby park bench, camouflaged by bushes. Michael watched the morning commuters, many lines of suits and bowler hats spaced at regular intervals, aided by the painted tiles beneath them. Trams came and went, skimming off the constant stream of commuters. After 20 minutes, his two sons appeared in their school uniforms, dashing for a carriage, piling on just in time. Michael waited until they were well out of sight, then left his hiding place and retraced his steps. As he neared his front yard, the neighbor opposite stepped out, raising an eyebrow at Michael's premature return.
"Forgot my sandwiches," called Michael in a strained, jokey tone.
Michael hastened inside, waving them goodbye, then slammed the door, cursing. He pulled off his tie, dumped his satchel, and headed down to the basement. He settled into his torn fabric seat, unlocked the desk drawers, and spread his research across the table. Over the years, the list of case studies he'd compiled had grown dramatically. Naturally, his efforts had accelerated now that he was jobless. With more time on his hands, he'd traced 4 new cases in the last few weeks alone. Old newspaper clippings, visits to the registry office, and cold calls all hinted at unregistered deaths, and a scandal brewing beneath it all. Owen Drakes, the man he'd met on the library tower, had vanished from the registry without a trace, despite being a living, breathing human just weeks ago. There wasn't so much as a fake name in his place. He'd been almost completely scrubbed. Almost. Through his research at the registry, Michael had discovered a recurring ministry code. The letters EF, followed by a 4-digit number and a date, appeared in death records, but only in very specific instances. Michael stumbled across the first recorded instance while investigating Owen's story, initially tracing his missing parents' records, then tracing his own. The code had appeared in the registry books the day Michael euthanized Owen in the hospital. As far as the public record was concerned, that discreet string of letters and numbers was the only hint that Owen had ever existed. This discovery prompted Michael to backtrack. He realized that the number in Owen's code was the next in a sequence. It followed on from the last EF, which he tracked down to a separate record dated 4 years prior. Following Owen's passing, Michael had hastily made a list of all of the EF entries and dates, then cross-referenced them against the newspaper archives for those days. It had been painstaking work, and he was on first-name terms with the staff at the facility now after repeated visits. That was until last week, when he arrived to find his access had been revoked. The staff were unable to explain why, but their demeanor had changed dramatically. Michael had packed up hastily and left before they could seize his notebook. Now, working from the privacy of his basement, he was drilling into the list of mysterious anonymous deaths. He was determined to discover the people behind the codes, but it was like hitting a brick wall. Michael had learned early on it was necessary to fish for details before revealing the true purpose of his call. Sometimes, he pretended to be conducting a consumer survey, anything but the truth. On the few occasions he'd led with, "I'm investigating some unusual deaths," the person on the other end would hang up before even confirming their name. So it was with great tenacity and patience that Michael had compiled this list of 18 suspected EFs, or extraordinary fatalities, as he decided to call them. Contacting the EF's surviving relatives, however, added to the complexity. Many had moved or died since their loved ones' disappearances. Michael spun the rotary dial and listened as the line rang.
"Hello,"
came the crackled response. "Good morning. Is that Mrs. Jensen?" The line went dead. That happened sometimes when the surviving relative had changed their surname following the death. Michael scrawled a date in the margin to remind himself to look into her new surname and try again in a few days' time. He dialed the next number on the list.
"Hi there. Is that Mr. Allison?"
said Michael.
"Speaking,"
came a clipped reply. "I'm calling from the law firm Plimpton and May. We've received some documents from your late wife's estate and believe you should be the beneficiary." There was a pause. Michael waited with bated breath for the man's reply.
"Like money?"
"Well, we would need to go through some standard vetting procedures before I can disclose the full details, Mr. Allison. Just to check your credentials, I'm sure you understand."
"What kind of details?"
"According to my records, your wife Eleanor died on October 18, 2 years ago. Is that correct?"
"It is."
There was a new tone in his voice, somewhere between pain and hope.
"Can you confirm the manner of death?" asked Michael.
"She got her letter, like anyone else,"
snapped the man. Michael allowed a silence to linger as the man stewed.
"Sorry, sir, that's not what it says here," said Michael.
"She drowned,"
conceded the man heavily.
"I'm sorry to hear that. You'll excuse the impudence of the next question, but we have to be sure is all. Was the drowning accidental or..."
"Or what?"
snapped the man. Michael allowed the silence to grow once again. "Thank you for your time, sir. Have a pleasant day," said Michael.
"Wait, what about the money?"
said the man.
"I'm afraid you didn't clear security. We can only distribute funds with verified individuals," said Michael.
"All right. She drowned, but she didn't get a letter. She did it herself. She chose to end it. Are you happy now? You made me say it."
"I'm sorry for your loss, Mr. Allison. I appreciate this must be a difficult conversation to have. But were you able to deposit your wife's body at the ministry after she died?"
"No. They took it from me. No idea where it went, but it wasn't to the ministry, that's for sure. When they pulled her from the water, they..."
The man welled up for a moment, then regathered himself.
"They put her in an unmarked police van. Or at least I'm guessing it was police. It was automatons that handled her. The vehicle drove in the opposite direction to the ministry and hospital. That's the last I saw of her."
"So you have no idea where they took her body?" asked Michael.
"Maybe they were driving to the mountains. That's all I can guess," said the man.
"Noted. Thank you, Mr. Allison. We appreciate your time. We need to do some confirmatory paperwork this end, then we'll be back in touch shortly."
Michael hung up and surveyed his spread of newspaper clippings. Lifting a sepia photograph printed on yellowing paper, he examined the image carefully. Woman pulled from lake after being found by runners. Husband distraught as... He punched the air and set up his typewriter. He had her. Michael tucked his report into a folder and stowed it securely in his satchel. If he hurried, he could catch the last mailing slot. He was banking on there being no line at the copy house. He needed several photocopies so he could approach all the news outlets while keeping the original for himself. As he marched down the street, a ministry capsule twirled into life. The capsule was about 3 feet taller and wider than Michael. Such portals were stationed on every street corner in the city, tall, bulbous tubes protruding from the ground. Some were made of translucent enamel, while others had been embellished to complement the color schemes of adjacent businesses. The capsule on Michael Street had been painted by a former resident, so he had been told, with permission from the ministry. It bore a painting of an automaton holding a child's hand against an ocean sunset. Michael had grown used to it, so never paid it much notice. But on this occasion, it caught his eye. For the first time in all his years living there, it was in operation. The capsule door rotated open, revealing an automaton and a woman. The woman had a red ponytail and seemed delighted to see Michael. She gave him a cheerful wave while chewing on a slice of pizza.
"Mr. Hadley? It seems we caught you at a good time. Heading out, are you?"
Yes, to the post office. Sorry. Who are you? Inquired Michael.
Detective Jane Clerkenwell. I was hoping we might ask you a few questions.
Really am in a hurry. It'll be closing soon, said Michael.
Anything important?
She said, nodding to his bag. No, said Michael hastily.
Good. Then I'm sure you won't mind us imposing for a few minutes. Shall we step inside? Nothing worse than gossiping neighbors, said the detective.
Michael glanced across the way at his curtain-twitching neighbor opposite. This way, he sighed. The woman and the automaton followed Michael home. The machine ceased gliding only to step over the doorstep before continuing into the living room. It parked itself in the corner with a fixed, inscrutable stare. Michael regarded it nervously. Was this one of the machines that had barged into his previous home, tearing its fellow automaton limb from limb?
Don't worry about my colleague. She's here for formality, that's all, said the detective.
Clerkenwell breezed in and made herself at home on the couch. She gave a nod to the family photo hanging on the wall.
Lovely family, she mumbled, shoveling more pizza into her mouth.
Thanks, said Michael, eyeing up the cream sofa anxiously.
How's the laundry machine?
What?
Heard a rumor it was broken.
It's fine, said Michael, perplexed.
Figures?
Nodded the detective.
Forgive the crumbs. Didn't expect you to be leaving at this time of day. Thought I had time for lunch, but then you checked out on the census, so we had to hot-foot it into one of the pods. Any idea why we're here, Mr. Hadley?
Nursing the satchel bag, Michael shook his head.
There was an incident at the library last week. You wouldn't know anything about that, would you?
An incident? Said Michael, conjuring his best innocent face.
Come now, Mr. Hadley. Let's not be coy. Your ID card places you at the scene. You bought a ticket for the rooftop tour, 11 a.m. Am I jogging your memory?
Yes. Come to think of it, I was there, and there was a slight incident. An old man fell from the roof, said Michael.
How do you know it was an old man? Said the detective.
It looked like he had white hair as he fell, and his voice sounded male, said Michael. The detective made a note, then peered up from her pad.
How interesting. You're the first person to say the person made a noise as they fell. Tell me, where were you standing at the time?
I was overlooking the east side of the city, the library parking lot, said Michael truthfully.
Any idea how someone was able to fall when there are safety nets all around the platform?
I guess he fell from higher up. There's another level by the radio mast, right? Said Michael. The detective made a note.
Some people reported seeing a second person on that level shortly after the victim fell,
said the detective. Why are you calling him a victim? Said Michael.
I beg your pardon?
The old man. Maybe he wasn't pushed. Maybe he jumped.
What makes you think that?
Said the detective. Odd place to try to murder somebody, isn't it? Said Michael.
Who said anything about murder?
He fell from one of the tallest buildings in the city. If someone pushed him, they would presumably be trying to kill him, wouldn't they?
The ministry decides whether people live or die, not people like you and I. If the individual received their letter that morning, then it is plausible they acted irrationally. But no letter was issued, Mr. Hadley, which means this must have been an attack.
Or a protest? Clerkenwell's brow soared.
Protest? At what?
Michael shrugged. You'd have to ask him that. The detective eyed him up for a moment.
That will be difficult. He's dead.
From the fall?
What do you think?
Michael held his tongue as the detective let him stew. After a moment, she continued.
I see two possibilities. The man was murdered and has been robbed of his ascension. Or the man sought to end his life and forego his ascension. In either scenario, a third party is required either to push or to follow the act through,
said the detective. Follow it through?
We found a further transaction on your account at the hospital gift shop. You bought flowers. Who were you visiting?
Said the detective. They were for my wife, said Michael.
I wasn't aware she was ill,
said the detective. She's not. I just wanted to get her flowers.
From a hospital?
It was the nearest shop.
To what?
My lunchtime walk.
I see. From your job at... yes, you were let go, weren't you? I believe it was the same day as your shopping trip,
said the detective. I was fired, so what? Said Michael.
The timing doesn't seem odd to you?
Said the detective. What's odd to me is that a man falling from the library roof hasn't been in any of the papers.
You've been looking?
I read them daily. I've seen no mention. Someone falls from the city's tallest tower and dies, and not a single paper writes it up. To me, that's more suspicious than the death itself. Smacks of a cover-up, shrugged Michael.
And who would be covering it up?
The Ministry. They don't want people to know the truth, that they're not the only arbiters of death, said Michael boldly. Finishing her last crust, Clerkenwell wiped her fingers clean on a napkin.
An interesting theory. Want to hear mine? Someone pushed the old man off the tower. Then, when that didn't kill him, they went to the hospital to finish the job. His life support machines were turned off, ripped clean out of the wall. Fairly amateur, if you ask me.
Maybe whoever it was just respecting the old man's wishes, said Michael, his eyes blazing. The detective smiled ever so slightly.
There's a term for that. It's called assisted suicide.
The automaton twitched sharply. The detective raised a hand as if soothing it.
It carries a life sentence. 30 years in an infinity chamber,
the detective continued.
Only one problem, said Michael, his heart racing. For there to have been a crime, there needs to be a victim, and the Ministry's already expunged the old man's entire life. How would the court case play out? An anonymous body with no records in the registry office, no mention of his death in the paper, no record of his stay at the hospital? It's like he never existed. Last time I checked, you can't murder someone who doesn't exist.
The detective's lips pursed.
You're quite right, Mr. Hadley. In the scenario you describe, it would be quite impractical for the Ministry to press legal charges. But you, of all people, should know there will be other consequences.
The front door opened and Olive spilled in from work, immediately kicking off her shoes and stepping into the living room. She recoiled in shock at the sight of the automaton and detective.
What's going on? She asked, alarmed.
Your father's been assisting us with an inquiry. He's been most enlightening,
said Clerkenwell, rising to her feet. Give us a moment, sweetie. They're just leaving, said Michael, stony-faced. Olive backed out of the room warily and retreated upstairs. The automaton glided into the corridor, following her, then stopped. Its head rotated towards the basement door. Michael's heart rate rocketed as it edged towards the handle.
We're done here. Get out of my house, he blurted, standing abruptly.
Gladly. By the way, I strongly advise you to reconsider mailing whatever it is you're about to mail. I'd hate for your situation to get more complicated than it already is,
said Clerkenwell, rising to her feet.
Oh, and for what it's worth, Mr. Hadley, I'm sorry about your daughter. That must have been difficult news to receive.
Michael looked at her blankly.
You don't know. I'll leave you to talk with your wife. You two have some catching up to do.
You know my wife?
Said Michael, taken aback. The detective whistled to the automaton, which was frozen with its palm placed flat against the basement door.
Let's go,
she called.
I'll see you round, Mr. Hadley.
Clerkenwell left, trailed by the automaton. Closing the door, Michael sank against the wall, hyperventilating. The detective's words echoed in his mind. I'm sorry about your daughter. What did she mean? And how did she know his wife? Kelsey was hiding something from him. It was the only explanation. She'd been acting so strangely lately, turning up at weird hours in the night, being evasive in person, and now the police are talking about their daughter? Michael hurried upstairs and ransacked his bedroom, searching Kelsey's things for clues. Panting and empty-handed, he stepped into the corridor, wondering where the hell his wife might hide something she wanted to keep secret. Olive was in the hallway, on her way to the shower.
Why were the police here, Dad?
Nothing to worry about, sweetie. They just wanted to know if Daddy had witnessed something. They're gone now, he smiled.
Olive frowned, then continued on her way. Michael waited until the shower was running, then hastily searched her bedroom, too. No drugs, nothing looked stolen, no plane tickets. He racked his brain, trying to think what Kelsey was hiding from him. A jolt came to him out of the blue. You've got your father's eyes. It had felt weird when she'd said it, but Michael had been too distracted to challenge her on it. At the time, he'd accepted her explanation, that Val had been showing her photos of his father, but that was impossible. She'd destroyed them all out of shame. There was only one copy remaining, and it was kept secret. Michael's stomach churned as he realized where Kelsey must have gone. He rushed to the basement and seized the dusty chocolate tin. Tipping the contents onto his desk, he shoved his grandfather's letters and family photos aside until he came across the outlier. There it was, and beside it, a new, crisply folded piece of Ministry paper. Michael's hands trembled as he picked it out from the pile. What had Kelsey done? What did it have to do with Olive? As he unfolded the paper, a familiar voice greeted him from the top of the stairs.
"We need to talk," said Kelsey.